This is an interview with Mark Fountain, recorded for the Australian Garden History Society's National Oral History Collection. I'll be speaking with Mark about his life and career at the Royal Tasmanian Botanical Gardens and the establishment of his own garden 12 kilometres from Hobart. This interview is taking place on Monday, the 16th of June 2025 at Mount Rumney, Tasmania. The interviewer is Jean Elder and our recorder is Rhonda Hamilton. The Australian Garden History Society acknowledges traditional owners of country throughout Australia. We pay respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures and to elders past and present. Well, Mark, we'll start at the beginning. I want to ask you about your early years, what year and where you were born and where you grew up.
I was born in Launceston in 1952, and I grew up there from obviously 1952, and I left when I was about 17 and a half, 18, and came down to Hobart. But my home life was in sort of outer suburban Launceston, and I was lucky enough to have parents who were both interested in gardens. And my dad's an agronomist, agricultural scientist. They were both 10-pound poms. They came out on the boat, and they were quite young. And their mum was in her early 20s, and dad would have been mid 20s. And I arrived very soon after. Dad had a job in the ag department up in Launceston, out of Mount Pleasant Laboratories, He travelled up and down the coast. He had a lot to do with developing the potato industry in Tasmania. So, and Dad eventually ended up being the Director of Agriculture and the Secretary of the Department of Agriculture and Fisheries before he retired. So.
And did they have quite a big property there? House?
No, it was a classic sort of suburban house in Chifley Street, sort of, and at the time we grew up, the street stopped about three houses past ours, and it was bushland down into the valley behind us, and that's where I spent a lot of my time as a child in the bush. And but Dad had, we had a classic suburban garden, fuchsias, hydrangeas, all of those sort of, they're wonderful plants, very active garden, but very thought about garden still. I had frog ponds and so they were very garden conscious. The front garden looked fantastic. The back garden was a bit more functional, veggie patch, and Dad borrowed a bit of land from our back neighbours to grow competition chrysanthemums. So I would go in and out when at flowering time. They would have a horticulture show in Launceston, in the City Hall in Launceston, and I would end up down there. I developed a good eye, I think, for what a good chrysanthemum should look like, from Dad. So that was a good education, really, for me. My education, and I've thought about this a bit lately, a lot of my education was out of periodicals that they used to put out in those days, and Mum and Dad thoughtfully bought these periodicals for myself and my brothers. I've got three brothers, I'm the eldest, and they were things like Understanding Science, which sort of gave you it had come out monthly, and we'd all avidly read them, and I owned them first, and the brothers all inherited them, and so I learned a little bit about science. I wasn't terribly good at science, I have to say. And I learned a little bit about science from them. And then I learned there was another set of magazines called Knowledge, which was broad knowledge, sort of history, general knowledge. Just, there was so much to learn. As a child, you just pack it in anyway, don't you? And then we had encyclopedias. We had children's encyclopedias, and I got very used to referencing. I was taught to reference things. If I wanted to know something, go to the encyclopedia, so you would, you know, it's a good way to learn. And so I had a good background. I think when I think about it now retrospectively, my parents taught me a lot.
It sounds like a very rich environment
for
a child to learn.
Yeah.
And this all was happening outside the schooling. Where were the actual schools you went to?
I went to Glendew Primary School, and I wasn't a very good pupil at all, I don't think. And I had an incident with a teacher, which I won't go into, in about grade four, which really put me off school. And I almost shut off, I think, and taught myself after that, even in high school. But I was reading, you know, we were regular library goers, so I was reading four or five books. I mean, by the time I got to high school, I was reading, you know, quite serious novels and things. So I think I taught myself, to be honest. And you
also read a lot of poetry and literature, apart from the novels you've described. At that recent lecture you gave at Government House, you described having a rather unusual childhood in that regard. And you talked about the book 19 Ways of Looking at Wang Wei.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit more about that.
That comes from, I think the interest in that comes from, I better have a glass of water, I think. The interest in that comes from another set of those periodicals called, probably, I think, I'm just imagining this is where it comes from. There was a set of periodicals called Discovering Art that I think they were called Discovering Art, and I love those, and I got really interested in art, and specifically in art from the sort of the Tang and the Song Dynasty periods in China, and I think the interest in poetry comes after that. You know, I learnt to look at those beautiful scrolls of Song Dynasty paintings, and they're the sort of landscapes you could imagine yourself walking into, and as a child I learned to do that. And
when you went to Hobart at age 17 and a half, what was that to do?
I came down to study art because I was really, most of my early childhood, that's what I wanted to be, an artist, and I wanted to be an artist. And I came down to study art, but a year in art school, I just decided that it probably wasn't for me. But I was also interested in writing, and interested in poetry. And I had a group of really good friends who were until one of my friends died earlier this year, were my closest friends, really. We've been in contact since then. And they're all either writers or artists, and one of my friends, my friend who died, is he lived in Japan for the last 30 or 40 years, and we all got interested in writers like the Japanese poet Basho and the. Me more than they, probably in the Chinese poet. I learnt to read Chinese poetry by, I think because I'm a bit of a dreamer. My mum always called me a dreamer. I learnt to read Chinese poetry, I can't read Chinese obviously, but there's an art to reading it, and you have to sort of kind of reverse engineer the English. You have to read English as images. And I think my background in art and my interest in literature probably enabled me to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I could actually read a Chinese poem. And Wang Wei's poems are utterly simple. You know, they're beautifully simple, and they're very descriptive. So, if you learn to read them, you can actually learn to appreciate them. You learn to read them the right way, you can appreciate them. I'm sure other people read them and think, well, you know, that was about nothing much. But you, if you see the sort of nuance in there, then you can actually pick it up.
So that started after you left art school. What did you do that? Well, how did that then go into TAFE? And
That period there, I sort of was more interested in writing. I was probably on the dole, as you could be then. And for a year, at least nearly a year, I was probably on the dole, I think. And I read copiously and was trying to write. And I was interested in where we lived, pretty simply. We all lived in an art studio, basically, which it cost us nothing. So that's what I was interested in. Then I worked in the library on an employment scheme for about a year and a half, which was a wonderful place for me, obviously. I learned a bit there. And coming out of there, I just decided I didn't want to sit down anymore. I wanted to be on my feet. I wanted to be physical. I wanted to be doing those kinds of things. And I'd always been interested in plants anyway. So I just decided I want to learn more about plants. What's the best way to do that? I thought, well, maybe I can find a job in a nursery. So I took the bus out as far as I thought I would be willing to go. I went out to Austin's Ferry and I started calling in to all the nurseries on the way back, just saying, do you want somebody to work? And just looking for work. So I called in to all these different places and I'd already determined I was going to go to TAFE and study. And I was coming in, one of them, Westlands Nurseries, one of the big commercial wholesale nurseries, said yes. So they'd come back next week. You know, and I was just lucky someone had left, and they sight unseen almost, and so they took me on, and I worked with them for quite a few years, and it was hard work, physically hard work, but the best place to learn. You're unbelievable. You know, you could pack in so many plant names and so much knowledge and so much learning about culture and horticulture. So it was wonderful.
And linking that then at the same time of being at doing the horticultural course of TAFE.
Yeah. I was lucky there. I went to horticulture and my two closest friends in horticulture, who did the course with me, were Michael Garrett, who's written the book Ferns of Tasmania, and Colin Allen, who became a landscape architect in the end. And we spent our weekends and any spare time in learning about plants. So we started in the foothills of Mount Wellington and gradually sort of spread out across Tasmania trying to learn plant names. And that's when I had Winfred Curtis's Flora of Tasmania with me, and I learned a lot.
So you did that at that time.
The same time as we were studying TAFE. Yeah. Again, in my way of learning is I probably learn more by myself than I learn in a classroom. I think collectively we did. It was TAFE then there were a couple of good lecturers, but generally the standard, if you look at it, if I think about it retrospectively, it was not anywhere near as good as it was later under Laurie Miller and with teachers like Lindsay Campbell,
mm-hmm.
and other, they had excellent group teachers there in those days.
Coming back to the field trips, were the particular things you're collecting, was that you had Winifred Coates?
Yeah, well, I was interested in everything, as I nearly always am. And Michael was became more and more focused on ferns. But that was good for me. I mean, it was an opportunity to go to all sorts of different places because people don't realise it, but ferns grow everywhere. if you know what you're looking for. So there's dry area ferns. We've got dry area ferns on top of Mount Romney up there. So, and there's, you know, so we would be, 1 week we might be in the deepest, darkest gully you could possibly imagine, and the next week we might be on top of a mountain. So, so we travel all over the place looking for ferns, all right around Tasmania, you know, right up in the northwest corner. I've got memories of walking up a, I was almost going to put it into the talk I gave. I've got this really strong memory of walking up a creek in northwest Tasmania called Copper Creek, I think at the time, and we were walking up this creek, which is in kind of rural landscape really, and we couldn't access where we wanted to go by crossing people's property, obviously. So we walked up the creek and we walked around this corner, and there was, we were after a specific fern, or Michael was after a specific fern, and we walked around this corner and there was this fern, really rare fern called a lime fern, or a Blechnum cartilaginium, and we came around the corner and this beautiful scene of Pomodoro sapetla, with this carpet of lime fern underneath, very simple, and it kind of has influenced the way I garden, I think, just the simplicity of that kind of vision. Those sort of things became quite sort of important.
You sound travels, amazing, yeah. Travels. Yeah. And you were, did you find the King's Holly? Was that one of the ones that you...
That was, well, no,
a bit late.
I've been to where King's Holly is, but Michael, one day, it's a good story to tell. One day Michael left a branch of this plant on the kitchen table with a little note saying, "Do you know what this is?" And I picked it up. I knew kind of what it was straight away, and I looked at it and I thought, it's one I don't know, and there's only one I didn't know, and that had been considered rare, and but that actually it was on the borderline of being considered extinct, I think. It hadn't been found for about 50 years, and it turned out to be Phobalium divisii. I looked at it and I said, I know what this is. And I called Michael and said, "Do you know what you've just found?" And he said, "No." I said, "It's Phobalium divisii. That hasn't been found for 50-something years." I said, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'll take it up to Dennis Morris, the botanist, and see what Dennis has to say." Dennis was one of Dad's employees, so he was a kind of almost like a family friend. So I took it up to Dennis, and Dennis already had his microscope out on the table when I told him that I thought I had Phobalium divisii, and he took one look at it as well and just said, "It is." So that got a fair bit of, I think it got in the paper and in the Mercury, and so it got people very excited. That was Michael's discovery. I never claimed that. I actually only identified it, you know, really. But Michael, of course, Michael's just in any creek in Tasmania, he's probably been in, I have to say.
That would have been really exciting, though.
Really exciting, yeah. I've been lucky with my time in the gardens, especially when I was at the gardens, to go into some extraordinary places.
Perhaps we shall start talking then about your time, which began in 1994, working for the Royal Tasmanian Botanical Gardens, which is the second oldest public botanical gardens in Australia, established in 1818, is that correct? So you had nearly a quarter of a century working there.
Make me sound old.
with a whole range of roles. Shall we start at the beginning? You began in 1994. Yeah. How did that happen? How did you get that job?
Well, I was headhunted by the new head. I'd actually He'd been there for a year and a bit, and he'd had a whole lot of sessions talking to the horticultural communities and really trying to get an understanding of where people thought the botanical gardens should go. So he was being very consultative, and I'd been invited in the year before, and as a horticulturist, and I don't know, you know, what had happened to get me invited there particularly, but and I went in and sat down, and they asked me questions about where I thought a botanical garden should be going, and I quite frankly told them where I thought a botanical garden should be going and should be doing, and I think David obviously liked what I said, and so, you know, not too long after that I was basically asked to apply for the job of nursery, head of the nursery at the Botanic Gardens, with my nurseryman's background. But I obviously got the job and went and started work there, but very quickly got out into other areas of the gardens. Almost within two or three years I was doing other things like project managing.
And then 5 years later you were the manager of the garden operations.
Yeah.
And then in the early 2000s acting director for a bit, and then you've played almost every senior role throughout the organisation.
A lot of senior roles at the gardens, and luckily for me, I've had some really good projects as well. I think that's probably, if I analyse what I've done at the gardens, the major things might be I project managed the Macquarie Island plant house project. That was very early on when I was still probably, I think I was still head of the nursery at that point, but doing that project management off the side. And so that was a really important project. I also had played a role in getting the seed bank, the Tasmanian Seed Conservation Centre, to established and set up. I was part of a team.
Tell us a little more about that, the importance of that.
Well, I personally think it's the most important thing the Botanic Gardens does, apart from educate people about plants, which is also about the importance of plants, which I also think is important, is an essential role of the Botanic Gardens. But the Tasmanian Seed Conservation Centre was established under the auspices of Q, and initially with quite considerable funding from Q, to collect and store Tasmania's seed gene pool, really. And we hired James Wood, who's we were lucky, extraordinary. He came from the Q Seed Bank, which is in their annex garden, which is the name of which has got straight out of my head. But James is one of those people who's just lives plants, and he's learnt so rapidly. I mean, I used to be a good field botanist. I wouldn't claim that anymore, and certainly not walking behind James. But
so, what was involved in setting it up? What was the work that he?
Well, setting up the seed bank itself, we had to physically build a seed bank. We had to learn what a seed bank was all about, and we had to do it on a scale. We couldn't do it at a Q-size scale, because everything that we do is duplicated and goes to Q essentially. So they're holding the world's seed bank there. We're holding Tasmania's. So we had to build basically a lab, seed cleaning and storing facilities, and a specialised cool room for storing seed and packaging and storing seed, And then the critical thing was to find the right person and someone who can sort of systematically go through the plant material and work out how to collect it, how to store it, how to clean it, how to test it. There's a whole range of processes that have to be undergone, and you know, you have to test viability before you can actually store. There's all sorts of processes, and James, as you know, Test Credit has set it up and has got it going, and has been gradually filling it up. You know, he's an amazing field botanist and very good at that sort of his job.
It was a crucially important thing to get established, though.
Indeed. You know, he'll be a challenge to replace, I'd say. He's still there, working away. Well, I hope he is.
Another project you talked about was when you worked with Mona on the development of the 24-carat school garden project.
My role there was, I was support, and I can't claim any credit for that at all. I was contacted by Kershaw when I was acting director and asked whether or not, we would be interested in helping support the project and being on the committee. So I was on the committee that founded it. I'd have to say my role was, it was very much driven by Kershaw, and I think it's a wonderful project. I think it's a brilliant project to be out there doing these sorts of things for kids in any kind of school. It wouldn't matter, but I mean they're working first on the lower socioeconomic kind of schools, but I think any school anywhere would value from having people in contact with plants and horticulture and especially with understanding food plants and all those aspects of life, just the whole bundle of life that goes around and understanding plants. So it's a brilliant project.
Were there other projects that stand out for you in that time?
I did the strategic master plan for the botanic gardens there. So it was a large scale strategic master plan that included understanding, because I have a strong belief that you need to understand to be able to plan. You need to understand your history in depth. You need to know what's happened before. That's the sort of groundwork for any kind of planning process in my mind. And so we did a history of the gardens at that point in time, and we analysed all the different areas of the gardens for their historical value. And then we looked at the gardens sort of from a landscape point of view. So it's quite a comprehensive sort of planning process, and it took a couple of years to get it all put together. We worked with Inspiring Place, Jerry DeGrasse's team, to do that.
What years was that roughly? Was that early 2000s?
Probably early 2000s, yeah, and probably somewhere in there. Yeah.
I just noted that when you were acting director in the annual report of 2014, you wrote of the importance, you talked about resilience in relation to the long-term sustainability, and that's probably part of that strategic plan too.
It was built into that thinking process, yeah. I think in any organisation, especially one, the botanical gardens, and I'm allowed to say it now because I'm not a public servant, but the botanical gardens has always been underfunded. And, it's at the bottom. It's quite understandably at the bottom end of a government's scale of funding. But I think, governments and organisations like governments tend to overlook the value of a botanic garden socially and communally. And I think they're incredibly valuable places. They have to sell themselves, and they have to kind of link to community, which we tried to do as much as possible. Certainly, when I was acting director, I always felt that we needed to be out there doing those sort of things, and doing and even creative events and arts events in the gardens brings people in. Even if they're not coming for the plants, they're there, you know, so they're still connecting. So there's value in that. So,
so you helped also develop quite a strong volunteer?
Yeah, I didn't play that much for I had a lot in the a botanical gardens is a team, you know, so there are always other people sort of playing this specific roles, and I always valued the volunteers. They're really important. The seed bank's got a wonderful group of volunteers who work there, and there's volunteers right across the botanic gardens who work in the nursery and front of house, and you know, I couldn't run without them, quite frankly. But so very important, and again another sort of community link that you know, they go out into community and they understand the value of the gardens, so they're ambassadors, if you like.
Which helps in turn, influencing politicians and getting more funding. I think we might just have a pause at this point. Now, Mark, coming back to the time of being in the Botanic Gardens early on, you know, I think in 1994, you did a fabulous field trip down in the southwest. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I went down into the southwest with a couple of botanists. I'm trying to think who they were, Martin Ayland and Jocelyn Cambacides, who was from France, and we were looking very specifically to find King's Holly, which we did very carefully, because in those days we were really worried about the disease Phytophthora getting into the population, and it's a proteaceous plant, so it's highly at risk from Phytophthora. So we washed down our boots and walked up the creek deliberately, and found one population on the first day, collected material. I was collecting material very specifically for a program at the gardens. We were going to try two things. We were going to try tissue culture and different grafting techniques, to make sure we could grow the plant in situ and keep it growing. And I think they, from memory, I was in the gardens a year or two ago, and I think they've actually just planted one out in the gardens for the first time. So that probably is from
right back then.
Yeah.
Fantastic achievement.
A lot of work and a lot of horticulture had gone into that, a lot of teamwork.
Did you get any of the southwest weather?
Not so much on that day. No, we had two reasonable days. It wasn't terrible. The second day we actually got back in and found what we think was an expansion of the existing population. We found a few more that hadn't been spotted before. So that was,
exciting.
Interesting sighting.
Yeah. And I also wanted just to, while you talk about your involvement with, you're a member of the Council of the Heads of Australian Botanical Gardens, what did you call them?
Charbag. It was a bit of a joke between us all, we called it Charbag, but it was a really important sort of opportunity to catch up with colleagues in other botanical gardens who were either directors or occasionally an acting director, but I went in as a proxy initially and in my acting director's role when I was at the acting director, and as a proxy for a couple of different directors I worked under. I always found that really valuable to be able to catch up with colleagues and learn more about their botanic gardens and how they function. There's so much to be gained from talking to people, especially people at that level. And I always learnt from it.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought it was a valuable thing. And one of the things that came out of that was we thought, you know, we're a small world, Australia. There's only, you know, seven botanic gardens. And, there's lots of other satellite botanic gardens that didn't get included in that process, even in Australia, the smaller gardens that deserved a role, deserved a place, deserved some sort of forum. And then we thought, well, we'll include New Zealand. This was probably an idea that Phil Moores, the director of Melbourne Botanic Gardens at the time, I think it was he birthed the idea, if you like. It may have come from somewhere else, I could be entirely wrong, but at the time I think that's where it came from. And and we sat down and we talked, we had some colleagues come over from New Zealand and to one of our council heads meetings, and we talked about the idea of Botanical Gardens Australia and New Zealand and making it a much more inclusive body that picked up a lot of these smaller gardens that didn't always have the botanic gardens title, but were still functioning like a public place for education about plants. So I think that was a really valuable time. And I was on the original committee that formed that, so I had a bit of a role there. I can't claim to be a major player, but I was just part of the team that forged that process, and I value that time.
Mm. And so that would be things like in Victoria, the small Castlemaine Botanic Gardens and those?
Yes, and all of those smaller gardens got included. And
which would give them support.
Yeah, and places like in Tasmania now, places like Inala, would be picked up. I think they've been grouped into, and even the Arboretum up north. Yeah, I think they're part of that forum. I hope they are.
Yeah.
We certainly asked them to be. So.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
And
that's
they were the sort of places we're hoping to pick up.
A very important role to play.
I think that was a really valuable. The organisation's valuable. I was also on the editorial committee of their magazine, in which we sort of helped grow, and that was the communication. So I was on that from the founding of the magazine until I retired, really. So.
Yeah, another important role. That during this time at the gardens, you started travel, of course. There would have been some work trips or giving conference papers.
Yeah.
You went to Japan a lot. And
I went to Japan once for work. Mm-hmm. And I was very lucky there. I got an email out of the blue asking me if I would like to talk at a World Orchid Conference. And I have to say, I knew a little bit about Tasmanian orchids, but not a lot. But I thought I could probably talk about them from the point of view of the botanic gardens. And so I went and asked my director if he thought it would be okay if I replied that I could do it. And he said, go ahead. And so I actually went and spoke to the then expert on orchids in Tasmania, and he was wonderfully helpful and helped me sort of put together a presentation and a paper and actually a display which we put together for this orchid conference, which was in a little town called Onomichi in Japan. And there were people from New Zealand and Russia and West Australia. One of my colleagues in botanical garden world from West Australia, Kingsley Dixon. I'm trying to think who else was there, but there were people from all over the place. From Japan, obviously. I think a Chinese speaker. So it was a really interesting conference, and just a wonderful opportunity, really. And I've wanted to go to Japan since I was a child, really, and so I couldn't not go. And I used that opportunity after that. I had time off and went and visited gardens and botanic gardens, and so I spent nearly a month there, I think.
Mm-hmm. And you also had visits in UK and
I spoke at a conference in Dublin for work on the master planning process. Part of the master planning process that looked at how you analyse plant collections for value to determine where they fit within, you know, your type of botanic garden. Mm-hmm. So it was actually one of those talks that I gave, and it's of all the talks I've given, it had the most feedback. I had lots of emails from different botanical gardens sort of asking me about the process afterwards, so that was a valuable thing to do, I think,
and rewarding by the sound of it.
And really rewarding. And I got the chance then to go to Dublin, and I used that opportunity to go to Kew. I spent 3 or 4 days at Kew with the Kew staff, sort of being shown around in the mornings, and then they gave me free rein to wander all over the place in the afternoon. So. And now I went down to their annex, and then I went to Eden Project. I had one of the speakers I'd brought over for a previous conference. Was the one of the founders of Eden, and so I got a guided tour of Eden, really, from the inside. And I spent a day with the staff at Eden Project talking about the process and what they were doing and how they were doing it. So I learned a lot there. Mm. So lots of opportunities, really.
Yeah.
You're always learning.
And just before we move on to talking about this wonderful garden here at Mount Rumney, I just want you to tell the story that you told at a recent, the lecture at Government House, about Winifred Curtis and she came to the Botanic Gardens. Quite early on, I think.
But all right, well, yeah, well, Winifred is an iconic figure in Tasmanian botany, really. She was a legend to me already. And then one day I just got a call out of the blue saying, could you give Winifred Curtis and some of her friends from her retirement home? None of whom seemed very retired to me. They were all mentally active and very busy. Whether I would give them a walk and talk around the Tasmanian, the nursery at the gardens, and so I took them around the gardens, showed Winifred what we were doing, and we were doing at that point we were doing, you know, lots of Tasmanian propagation of Tasmanian plant material. That's when I was still in the nursery, and we were collecting in the wild. And so I could actually go through and take her through and show her all sorts of things. But I also took her out, and she showed me the site of where she thought the original herbarium was, which used to be in the gardens. The first herbarium was in the gardens. It was basically a wooden hut. We've got an old photograph of it. So she went out and had a look at that. But then, at the very end of all of that, we sat down with the ladies, and they'd all bought lunch, and I hadn't thought to bring lunch. And Winifred shared one of her kiwi fruit and cucumber sandwiches with me. And I was lucky enough to be able to tell her how much I valued her books and how much I'd learned from her books. I'd learned so much that I could read them. I read the books, and I could walk into the field, anywhere really in Tasmania, and even if I didn't know a plant, I'd if I remembered the description, I would know it. You know, I could actually go based on what I've read in Winifred's book, that's such and such. So I learnt so much, and I read those books cover to cover many times over, I think.
Right. She was a remarkable person. Oh, that's a lovely story.
She was special. Yeah.
Now, I think we'd like to hear more about the establishment of this gorgeous garden here at Mount Romney, which you describe as a demanding garden. And in relation to this aspect of your life, you describe yourself as a hermit gardener.
Yeah. Well, I am these days. I spend so much time here that I feel like a hermit some days. And I don't really mind being a hermit, to be honest. But, this place, it was a garden before we came here. It was a garden, a really classic Australian plants garden with a lot of grevilleas and broad Australian plants mostly from the eastern seaboard, but it was kind of getting towards the, you know, it was getting a bit overgrown, I suppose, when we moved in. But it had been in a book. It was in Diana Snape's book, Australian Gardens. I'm trying to think the title of the book, but it was a 1992 book. Within that book, so it already had a history as a garden. So we moved in 1996, and we looked at the garden, the shape of the garden, and some of the beds we haven't changed at all. Some of the beds remain almost as they were in the original garden, especially out in the sort of the centre of the garden there. Other places, parts of the garden, we've changed quite a lot. It's driven by a couple of things. It's driven by climate change. I'm a horticulturist. I don't think any horticulturist is going to disagree with the idea of climate change. I've been growing plants since I was in my 20s, it's an absolute fact that the climate is getting drier and summers are getting hotter. And we've felt that here in the nearly 30 years we've been here. So we've changed the garden to work better under those circumstances. We've simplified the garden to make it sort of visually stronger, I think. Those sort of processes.
And the influence for some of that, was that where Thomas Church in the US influenced you?
Well, I was certainly influenced by Thomas Church because I got interested in mid-century modern house design, because the first house I ever bought in Hobart was up South Hobart, and it was a kind of an Australian, a poor Australian copy of a mid-century modern design. And then we moved into this house, which is a much better example of mid-century modern, with the post and beam style a roof and the angled roof. And you couldn't actually build a garden that didn't pick up some of that feel. Here we thought, because I work the garden now is we work I work with my wife to develop the garden, so we work in collaboration, and there was no way we were going to not include those elements. And Thomas Church came from that kind of thinking. Thomas Church was working in the sort of 30s 40s pretty much, and his style picked up elements of modernism, elements of abstract art, and some hints at Japanese garden design as well. But the modernism is particularly evident in his work. There's a sort of abstract quality to it. And we used that as a guide. So he was particularly important.
And your visits to Japan, you see the evidence in the paths and the some of the plantings and some of the pruning.
Yeah, some of the design elements. I think, and I've definitely Japanese gardens, and some of the Japanese gardens you can walk into. I mean, some of the famous ones like Ryoanji, the stone garden. You can walk into that garden. And, you know, it's contemporary now. You know, it hasn't aged one iota. It's extraordinarily contemporary. And there's other gardens in Japan. There's a famous garden, Daichiji, which is out near Lake Biwa. And that's... that's a sculpted series of azalea hedges, which could be now, you know, it looks very contemporary, but it was 1880s or so. So it was built, you know, many years ago, and maybe even before that. I'll have to actually look that one up. We'll have to fact check that one, but. That's another famous garden in Japan. What I liked about Japanese gardens, A, was the simplicity, and that quality of being contemporary and ageless. You know, I think fits with mid-century modernism, and so we were thinking along those lines when we used those influences. And we used the influences of one of the more contemporary, he was working in the 1930s to the 50s and 60s. It was Mire Shigemori, who was a Japanese garden designer. He wrote huge number of volumes on the history of Japanese gardens as well. So he was deeply steeped in Japanese garden design, the traditional Japanese garden design, but he kind of broke the boundaries and became a very contemporary. I mean, I don't like, there's some of his really contemporary work, you know, I question it, sort of pushed the boundary a bit too far in my mind, but some of his work, like his early work, like Tokufuji, the one in the talk with the moss squares, that I've always loved that garden, and another garden I visited on the island of Kyushu. Forgive my pronunciation; I'm not very good with my Japanese pronunciation, but. That particular garden was very valuable to me. The name of that one's gone straight over my head as well.
So these, when we look out the window and I can see pavings and stonings and gravel paths and bonsai
stonework
and plants, how do those all, you've pulled all these elements together and the final result is just amazing. Because you've still got the Australian bush.
We wanted to do two things. We wanted to meld this garden with the bush. I mean, I've always loved the bush anyway, from my childhood right the way through to my horticulture years wandering around with my colleagues. So I've got a deep appreciation for the bush and the way it looks and feels. And so I always wanted to live in the bush and work with the bush as a kind of a backdrop. And the garden is designed to sort of fit and meld with the bush, but it's also been consciously designed to be a little bit more fire safe. You know, that's the reason I use big sweeps of Myoporum and Parvifolium, which is, in a way, in my mind, it's not unlike moss in Japan. You go to the Seiji, the famous moss temple, that's just a green, multiple colours of green underneath, and So I'm kind of playing with that effect to a degree as well, I think.
Because you rely on tank water here?
We're on a water scheme, but we pay for our water. So we don't water the garden. I water the plants with the water we pay for, and I water my nursery with it. But the garden doesn't get watered at all unless it's an emergency. And so if we're getting to that point in the summer, and we got there last summer, and we've had. Since we've lived here, we've had quite a few years where we've had to use the tanks. I just get the generator out and we start putting water on the plants we regard as precious. And that's mostly the big trees. I don't want to lose any of my framework eucalypts or any of those sorts of things. So if we lose other things, then so be it to a degree. We live in the bush, we have to accept that kind of collateral damage, I think. And we also live in a place that's, you know, potentially fire risk, and we have to accept that kind of risk as well. You have to be a bit of a Buddhist about those things. I think I'm not a Buddhist, but you have to have a kind of mindset where you're ready to accept these things.
Mm-hmm. So that there is a sort of balance between the sustainability and the aesthetics.
It's sustainability and I think I said it in the talk, it's about resilience. It's making a garden that survives but still manages to look okay under difficult circumstances. There's lots of the gardens unfinished. I think I also quite frankly said that in the talk, that the garden is we've still got a lot of work to do, and we're in our 70s now, so we're coming to the realisation that we've actually got to get it done quite quickly, we're working quite hard at the moment to get some of these projects done, but we want a garden that in the end we're just gardening in, but we're still in very much in construction mode at the moment, so which is a bit frustrating, but I have to admit I love building stone paths, hard work but fun.
Yes, they're beautiful, the different patterns, and again you see the Japanese influence in your stone paths.
We were lucky to move on to a ridge line with lots and lots of exposed stone, flat stone, and it didn't matter where you dug, the stone would come up. So we ended up piling. I ended up hand selecting out all the flat top ones, and they gradually ended up into pathways. So
this. What does it mean to you being in this beautiful contemporary environment with the nature and the landscape?
It means everything. It's pretty special when you can get up in the morning and you can look out the window, and it doesn't matter in this house at the moment. There's a few places where you don't want to look because there's they're not tidy and they're not finished, but most places you look here, you can look out and there's things to see. There's usually, because we've got quite a bit of water in the garden, so there's usually quite a lot of bird life. Not so much today because it's windy, but there's usually birds. If we'd been sitting here normally, there'd be birds out in the reflecting pool out there. And occasionally you'll have a wallaby wander down there and drink out of that reflecting pool.
And so the wildlife you live with too, don't try
we accept that a lot of collateral damage actually, they do. You can see we've got wire out there at the moment protecting plants, but in certain times of the year when there's no food out there for them, they really give the garden a hard time. We have to accept that. We try and live with nature. And I think people are going to have to do that more. Even things like aphids. You know, I think people have got to accept that aphids are actually food. They're food for insects and they're food for small birds. And one of my other interests is the bird life, and I'm part of Landcare Australia. I'm the president of the local Landcare group here, and we are currently running bird surveys every month, and we have been for this year, but we've become part of a survey of birds in the southeast, so we're starting to get an understanding of what birds are in our area, and that'll give us a bit of an idea of numbers. But evidently, right across Australia, bird numbers are dropping dramatically. And if we don't do things, if we keep spraying things like aphids, or any other insects, if we don't do something to maintain biodiversity, then we're at risk of losing things that are precious. And it's hard to get people to understand that,
mm-hmm.
this, but I think you've got to let go of some of your, as a human, you've got to let go of some of these things that we regard as important, like, you know, your perfect azalea or your perfect this or that, and accept that there's other things involved in this process.
Yes,
you know, sort of,
it's part of a bigger picture.
Not just humans. Yeah.
So your Instagram and Flickr sites are probably quite important in terms of educative things about your garden.
I don't have that many followers, and I'm not really an ardent. I mean, I'm not doing it. I was doing it originally for me as a diary, but I realised that, you know, I might as well say what I think. And so hopefully, you know, the people who do follow me, you know, get some information from that. Flickr, not so much. Flickr was, you know, like, it's like a repository of images. And I don't use that much these days. It changed. It used to be have a sort of a more social element to it. And I have, you know, I had some great friends that I made through Flickr, and people in places like California that I've actually visited. And when I went to America, I visited a friend who lived in Northern California, an artist, and I went to his place, drove up his driveway, and his house is surrounded by Madrone and sort of thinking that the species of the other one. It's gone out of my head, but the most beautiful trees with these fantastic trunks and so you know, you're lucky. You meet people on those sorts of things, and he's still in contact with him fairly regularly. So,
wonderful.
Yeah,
and share those images as well.
Yeah,
but since your retirement, although I hardly think see you as being retired. You're busier than ever. But you also did some work for the that renowned garden in Dalness in northern Tasmania.
Yeah, yeah.
And what were the challenges facing those old gardens in a changing environment that we've been talking about?
Dalness is an interesting garden, and We did quite a large scale report for it. That's the report there, and you know, it's one of those gardens where it's got a lovely old house. It's got a beautiful parkland, magical parkland with a fantastic oak tree out the front of the house and a circular carriageway and a big avenue of oaks leading up to the entry point, and it had an interesting history. So they originally asked us to come in and do a bit of an analysis of the site, and to let them know what they had in both the garden and the parkland. And it was quite a complex process that we broke down. So in the end, I gave them a bit of a précis of the history of Tasmanian gardens in about two or three pages, if you could do that. And then I tried to kind of put Downes in context within that history, and to give them an idea of where the garden sat historically and the value of it historically, because it was clearly valuable. They had an old plan that the previous owner had of a much more sort of formal garden layout that didn't appear to have been actually constructed, except maybe a bit of evidence in places. And so it was a point in time analysis of that landscape, and that garden was the key fact. But we also tried to place the place historically. So that was interesting. I also did some work with Jerry de Grijs on a historical garden, on the governor's garden at Norfolk Island, with Inspiring Place Again. And so we did a kind of overview of the government house garden at Norfolk Island, which was a really interesting process. And I've been lucky to work with some interesting people. Work with the architect Richard Laplastre, and at one point down on Bruny Island, he was building a house down there. And we just looked at the landscape from an ecological, horticultural point of view. So,
in terms of designing a garden.
Yeah, designing a garden that was basically facing out towards Cloudy Bay, sort of almost on dune sands, and so it had to be thought about completely differently.
Mm-hmm. Mm, and very wonderful experiences.
Oh, lucky, really. Lucky. I mean, that's what horticulture can do, and that's what's valuable about horticulture in my mind, that it can give you a whole life, and it can create sort of deep value that's ongoing. And I mean, it's ongoing here now. This garden probably be never ending. The reality is
gardens never end.
They never end. I mean, we're planting plants now that I know I'm not going to see grow to their
maturity
in any way. But I can actually go out and sit there in the garden, and I can visualise what they're going to look like. And that probably goes right back to dreaming my way into Song Dynasty landscapes.
I think at that note, we're drawing to the end.
That's a bit circular. That's good.
It's very circular. Are there any areas that you'd, anything, final things you'd like to pick up on, Mark?
I'm just trying to think. The one thing I haven't mentioned, and well, we talked about it initially, but with the poetry.
Yes.
And the one thing I mentioned it in the talk. I think there's something about gardens and the idea of visual poetry that is probably another driver for this landscape in my mind anyway. You want gardens to be a sort of kind of sequential pictures, if you like, and I quite like to be able to make this garden into something like that. We're going to be photographed again, evidently, we're hoping to be, by Claire Takacs, the Australian garden photographer. And she's doing a garden on contemporary Australian and New Zealand gardens, a book rather, on contemporary Australian and New Zealand gardens. And she's hoping to include us in that, but we're going to be very weather dependent and project dependent, so we've got a lot of work to do before that happens. But yeah, so I'm looking forward to that, really.
Yeah, in some ways you're talking about the garden as a poem.
Yeah, I think so. I think gardens are a kind of poem, a visual poem. Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's wonderful. I think I conclude and thank you for sharing your amazing story, Mark.
And halfway cohesive.
And obviously your deep passion for the world of plants. Your story encompasses such a diverse array of experiences, and it's wonderful to see how this knowledge channels into this garden, this visual poem here at Mount Rumney. And of course, just your teaching and the work at the Royal Tasmanian Botanical Gardens, there's some long-lasting outcomes of that.
Yeah, I hope so, yeah.
And so, again, many thanks for participating in our Australian Garden History Oral History Collection.
Oh, well, thank you.